Welcome back, everybody.
Hi there, man.
What's that?
Good to see you all.
Hockey player coming
Hope
up.
everybody's staying safe.
For us or
Okay.
for
Question.
update.
One
Good.
of the most one of the most famous songs that we sing Friday night. If you go to shul or even if you daven at home, the famous song of Lecha Dodi Lekrat Kala, where we talk about welcoming in the bride that we call Shabbos. Famous, and there are many, many beautiful tunes that are sung. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have taken literally 4 minutes, 5 minutes tops to actually read what the words say, other than the opening line? Do you have, great, Arlene, fabulous,
Yeah.
beautiful, Sandy, excellent. There's a few of you. Do you notice a lot of themes about Shabbat?
No.
No, you
Yeah.
don't. It's
No.
almost nothing about it. It's one of the wildest, weirdest things ever. This is like the crown jewel of our singing, of welcoming in the Shabbos queen. We're so excited. There's almost no mention of it whatsoever. The theme that runs through the entire Lecha Dodi is a step-by-step progression that talks about Jerusalem, talks about the fact that we're still in exile and we anticipate being redeemed back to Jerusalem. It's not for tonight as to why that is the theme that's discussed on the
There
highlight prayer of Shabbat. I'll give you a hint for you to think about, but there's two arenas of sanctity when we talk about Judaism. There's two arenas in where sanctity takes place. One is the concept of sanctity of time, and one is sanctity of place. There are
you
certain places in the world that are more holy, are more sanctified than other places. Like, for example, if you were to go in a orderly manner as the top city in Maryland that represents the highest level of sanctity, Frederick would be up there. That would probably be the Why are you laughing? Okay, right? There are definitely places in the world that are more like Israel. Over, right? And within Israel, you have cities like Jerusalem and even neighborhoods within. So you have a concept of sanctity of place, and then you have sanctity of time, like festivals, Shabbat. Right? So there's two aspects and they are linked, and there is a parallel. Perhaps for your homework, you can delve into why this the song of Lecha Dodi, which in theory is talking about Shabbos, is really also talking about the sanctity of not just time, but sanctity of place and Jerusalem. But for tonight, just going to pick the fourth stanza. The fourth stanza at this point, most of us, if we're into the song, we're not even reading the words and we're just clapping and we're singing and we're really into it. And if we're not involved, I promise you, you've never even known there was a fourth stanza. I figured that. But let's read what it says. It says, Hisnari me ofer kumi, livshi big day tefartech ami. And in case you don't know what that means, I'll translate. Shake off the dust, arise. Put on, don your splendid clothes, my people. Through the son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, draw near to my soul, redeem it. It's talking about Jerusalem and its relationship to the Jewish people. Shake off the dust. Get out of your slumber. Get up. Put on your good clothing, oh, my people, the Jewish people. Through the son of Jesse, otherwise known as King David, who is the harbinger, right, the ancestor of Mashiach, of the Messiah, the Bethlehemite, he came from Beit Lechem, that was his area. Draw near to my soul, redeem it. I'm not going to get what? Yes, Liz.
King David's name is Jesse?
No, his father.
Oh, okay. Okay. Sorry.
His father in Hebrew is known as Yishai.
Okay.
Yishai in English, they translate as Jesse. So
Okay.
the son of Jesse, slash, that's David. Sorry. Arlene?
Yeah, draw near to my soul. Doesn't that relate to Shabbos when you elevate yourself to be closer to God for Shabbos?
Good. Excellent. You're 100% right. And that is one of the connections in this stanza. Very good. Okay. But I want to focus on the first line. It is such a strange expression. Shake off the dust. Were there no paved roads? I mean, like, what are we shaking off the dust about? I mean, that sounds like a great title for a great pop song. Shake off the dust. You know, off your blue suede shoes, says Elvis. Yes, Arlene.
Okay, because I do read it, and I get a whole different meaning from Lecha Dodi of shaking off the dust is all the imperfections that I've gathered around me for during the week.
Excellent. I don't disagree in any way. That's an excellent and a true insight.
But isn't that Shabbos?
It is.
Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing on Shabbos?
It is. But okay. Isn't it strike you strange that this is a call to the Jewish people to become redeemed and resume our noble ways in the way it used to be? Yet you use the terminology, we should shake off the dust. Like, we're going to bring the redemption. All I got to do is just, you know, get a good shake and we got this. Like, we're holding it back. We're ready. God, just give me the word. I'm ready to roll. Is it really up to us? Are we the ones refusing to become redeemed? We should shake off the dust. So allow me tonight to share with you a beautiful insight that I learned a few years back. But to appreciate this, we have to do another story. It's not from this week's Torah portion. It's from an earlier one, from just really 2 weeks ago. We know the story, and we talked about this, of where after Jacob dies, he had made his children promise not to bury him in Egypt, to carry him all the way to Hebron, right, to the cave of Machpelah, where the other patriarchs and matriarchs were buried. And sure enough, and we know the story is that they do it, they bury, and then we know when we focus on Yosef and his brothers. But there's a little tiny section that happens. There's a story that happens as they get to the cave of Machpelah. There's an uninvited guest who decides to join and meet at the funeral. Who is this uninvited guest? His name is Uncle Esau, Jacob's brother. Oh, time out. Esau now comes and he wants to stop the funeral procession. He says, wait a second, folks. Jacob and I were twins. There is only one spot left, or there were when after we buried our father, Isaac, and our mother, Rebecca, there were only two spots left. There were only eight spots. Adam and Eve, Abraham and Sarah, and Isaac and Rebecca. That's six. There's only two spots left. Esau says, Jacob made the decision that he's going to give one of the spots to his dear wife, Leah, who passed away, and she is buried there. Says Uncle Esau to his nephews and says, sorry, we were two spots. One was for him and one was for me. He chose to give his spot to Leah. That's fine. But that last spot is for me. You do not get to bury Jacob in that spot. And the nephews, all of the 12 sons of Jacob are arguing and saying, no, we have the deed that says that it belongs to us. Esau, you were cast away. You have nothing to do with this anymore. This is it. And they're arguing back and forth and back and forth. And in fact, they even send one of the brothers, the fastest of them all, Naphtali, to run back to Egypt to go bring the deed that says it belongs to this family. And Esau has no part in it. Sounds like a great story. But listen to the conclusion of the story. One of the brothers, his name is Dan, Dunn. Dunn, the Torah tells us, had only one son. All the other children, all the other brothers had multiple children. Dunn had one son. An interesting name, no less. The Torah tells us his name. His name was Chushim. Chushim. Okay. Interesting name. Why would he be called Chushim? The word in Hebrew, chush, means sense. S-E-N-S-E. Not common sense, but using your five senses, right? one of your senses. His name is Chushim, which is plural for senses. Okay, I'm going to name my kid Common. Why? Because his last name is Sense. And my child is Common Sense. That's crazy. I'm like, who names their kids senses? Like, what kind of name is that? Great insight, our sages tell us. Chushim had a disability. Anybody know what his disability was?
Here, he was deaf.
He was deaf. Yeah. He was deaf. You're looking at me like, Liz, you think this is a new concept? Nobody ever before the ADA came along and invented these concepts. There were people who had disabilities long before. The Tanakh is filled with people that have disabilities. There's places where they talk about people in what we would call a wheelchair. There are people that are lame. There are people that are mute. I mean, this is all in Tanakh. There's nothing new. This son, Chushim, was deaf. And the story goes that Chushim is watching this. He's watching the exchange between Uncle Esau and his other uncles, Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, etc. And he can't make heads or tails. They didn't have sign language. I guess he wasn't a lip reader. So he has no idea what's going on. And he surveys the situation and sees that his grandfather, Jacob, this is such a disgrace. The funeral procession is stopped. They're not burying his Zaidi. He's like, he's getting all worked up over this. He doesn't know why everybody's arguing and fighting. And he said, this is not acceptable. He took his sword and he chopped off Esau's head.
That is a conversation.
Some of you may have heard this midrash before. So just as a little sidebar, a little piece of trivia, if you're ever playing Jewish Trivial Pursuit, and the question is, how many people are buried in the Cave of Machpelah? Please make sure you get the right answer. It's 8 bodies in 1 head. That's the correct answer. Because Esav's head is also there. Not the rest of his body, but his head. Oh my God, Liz, are you okay? Should we call 911? I mean, you're having a connection over there.
Why just his head?
Because that's what rolled, and they understood that was a sign. This is the way it's to be. Don't mess with these kind of things, folks. Okay. Why am I telling you this story other than to catch your and capture your attention? Because, you know, that's what I need to do. The question that the commentators ask, amongst many, is why is it only this deaf guy is the one who was asking the question? He's the only one that seemed to be bothered and upset about the situation. Why aren't the other brothers ticked off and get rid of Esav some way, maybe not chop his head off, but I don't know, neutralize him, get him away. First, get the job done. Get Zaidi buried. And then you can, you want to have an argument, let's argue. Get the job done. But nobody else seems to be worried about this. They're arguing, but only Chushim felt that this was a disgrace of a situation and action needed to be taken. None of the other brothers did it.
But how do you know to go after Esau?
He sees the... Listen, if you had an Uncle Esau, you'd know who was on the winning side. Right? It was clear from the conversation that everybody's on one side and Esau's on the other of this argument. And he felt that Esau's holding up the whole funeral, which is a disgrace to Jacob. The great leader of the Jewish people who passed away in the 1970s, was a man by the name of Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz. I've quoted him before. Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz was one of the great leaders of one of the largest institutions of Torah learning and studying called the Mir Yeshiva in Jerusalem. One of the largest in the world. I have a son, thank God, who studied there. And I think the plan after his wedding in a month, he's planning on going back there. It's one of the most world-renowned institutions of Torah, higher Torah learning. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz suggested the following. And it really keys in on something that we are all susceptible to. It's human nature. We become adaptable and then become complacent to the new norm. We are pre-programmed that we don't like to be uncomfortable. Even if a situation is not great, you ultimately get used to it. And that becomes your new norm. It's a terrible example, and I don't wish this on anybody. But there is enough statistics. There are enough statistics that show that people who are in terrible relationships, even if it's not to the extent of domestic abuse, emotional or physical, it's just not a good relationship, they stay in it. Why? Get away. Because we become complacent. I guess that's just the way it is now. There's no way to change that. As the situation is going on, each time there's a back and forth conversation between Jacob's sons and their uncle, Esau, each time they said, oh, this is going to be the winning argument against Esau. We're going to win. We can, and then we'll deal with it. And then Esau had a back volley. And they said, no, no, we can look at it like this. No, no, that's not true. And this volley keeps going back and forth. Meanwhile, time's ticking. And now this becomes the new norm. Yaakov is laying there in disgrace. And everybody in the party who's watching this or involved with this becomes accustomed to the situation and they accept it, that this is the now. Yes, we'll deal with you, Zadie, in a minute while we have to deal with our new situation. And what just happened is that the priorities completely went backwards. Where the priority was deal with the deceased. That is primary number one, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Then you deal with the ancillary stuff. But as time went on, and my argument and his argument, and my argument and his argument, and this volley of back and forth, that became the new situation that they adapted to, and it became the new norm, and nobody even realized what was going on anymore, how they had flipped their priorities. The only one who still remained as an objective observer of the whole thing is the one who couldn't get involved. Yeah, his disability was his greatest strength at that moment. He didn't get sucked into the new norm. And therefore, it required and allowed him, he understood. And he was jolted into action. He was facing this question of, what is going on? Not because he was a yenta, but I don't get it. How did we just get into this whole back and forth with Uncle East? Zadie's sitting right here. He was jolted by a major question that how does Jacob remain unburied? And therefore that drove him to action. I asked you the question, what? I asked the question about the Luchadodi. The opening phrase, shake off your dust, arise. You know what that means? It means stop being complacent. Get up. Shake it a little bit. Stir the pot. You have to be able to get a little jolt. Don't just accept things for the way they are. Question it. Sometimes you get a good answer, and that's fine. You can stay in that situation. You got a satisfactory answer. But more than half of the job was done by asking the question. You have to be able to stop putting your life on cruise control. That's what we do. We find our comfort zone and we set it on cruise and we just keep going. Do we ever stop to touch the brake and say, is this really the right thing? Have my situation changed? Do I need to adapt to something else? Have I lost my priority? I love to tell the story of the guy who's running to catch the train. And he finally gets on the train and he sits down and he's catching his breath and he turns to the guy next to him and he says, oh, where are you going? He says, I'm heading to New York. And all of a sudden the guy looks at him and he says, New York? I thought this was a southbound train and we're heading towards Florida. He says, no, this is a northbound train. He goes, oh, shoot. And he gets out of his seat and he starts running in the opposite direction on the train. Yeah, like that's going to get a lot done. But that's what I feel like sometimes in life, that's what we do. We don't even bother to ask what direction we're going. And when we do, we're like, oh, really? Oh, okay, I'm going to try this. Seriously. We become so, let me put it this way. There is a certain positivity of being able to adapt. If we didn't adapt to situations, we would all be dead. We have to learn to roll with punches. Welcome to 2020. Welcome to COVID-19. Welcome to the new reality. I get it. We have to adapt. And thank God there's 15 or 13, whatever, a number of us here that have adapted to learn Torah via Zoom. Great. And it's a wonderful thing. But if we start accepting all of this as the new norm and we don't question, should I, can I do something more? Can I do something better? Am I harnessing the power the way I could? Then we're making that same mistake. And we're just accepting it as the new norm without questioning it. Why am I sharing this with you? Because I believe this is really the key to understanding in our Torah portion this week. This week is Parshat Va'era. Va'era, not to be confused with Vayera, which was about 2.5 months ago in the book of Genesis. Va'era is our Parsha. It's the second in the book of Exodus. And in the beginning of the Parsha, it is perhaps one of the most famous speeches that God shares with us. It's a conversation that God is reassuring Moses that now that you've gone down to Egypt, and at the end of last week's portion, things got even ratcheted up even harsher for the Jewish people. Pharaoh took away the straw and they had to make their own bricks, but the quota was the same. And everybody's crying and screaming to Moshe, what did you do? Why did you make it things hard? Our parsha begins with God reassuring Moshe, the time has now come. Watch, and I will show you with all of my signs and my wonders and the miracles I'm about to bring and take the Jewish people out of Egypt. Why do we have 4 cups of wine at our Passover Seder? Because there were 4 different expressions of redemption that God uses to talk about the Exodus. And that comes from the beginning of this week's Torah portion. God spoke to Moses and said to him, and he goes through, I'll skip the first parts of the sentences, the first few. Therefore, God says, this is verse number 6 in chapter number 6. Therefore, say to the children of Israel, I am Hashem, and I shall, here we go, take you out from under the burdens of Egypt, number 1. Number 2, I shall rescue you from their service. Number 3, I shall redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. And number 4, I shall take you to me for a people and I shall be a God to you. And you shall know that I am Hashem, your God, who takes you out from under the burdens of Egypt. 4 different expressions. In Hebrew, Vahotzeiti, I will take you out. Vihitzalti, I will save you, rescue you. Vigaalti, I will redeem you. And Vilokachti, I will take you for me as a people and I will be a God to you. Now, again, just for full disclosure, there's one more. The verse that comes right after it, verse number 8. I shall bring you to the land. I will bring you. Perhaps this is the reason why we do actually have a 5th cup at our Seder. We don't necessarily drink it as a 5th cup, but you all know it by another name. Elijah's cup. That is a reference to the fact that Elijah, being the prophet that we are told tradition, that he will be the one to herald in the Messiah, to announce his arrival, which ultimately will lead to the Jewish people all going back to the land of Israel, which is what expression number 5 is referring to. But the 4 expressions, but I want to point out a few things. The very first expression is very, very, how do I say? It is so rich with meaning and understanding. Therefore, say to the children of Israel, I am Hashem, and I shall take you out from under the burdens of Egypt. In Hebrew, it says, Vehotzeiti etchem, I will take you out, mitachat, from underneath, sivlot Mitzrayim, the burdens of Egypt. It's a good translation. Sivlot means burdens. But one of the great Hasidic masters had a different take on it. In Hebrew, something that almost all Israelis are lacking. If I had to ask you, give me a one character trait that just about all Israelis are guilty of not having, what would it be?
Patience?
Yes, patience, tolerance. You ever walk, ask an Israeli, they go like this, right? They give you the, like, come on, shnia. There is no tolerance, no patience whatsoever. Yes, I'm stereotyping, very not PC right now, but sorry, it is still true, okay? The word for tolerance in Hebrew, patience, savlanut is patience, tolerance. Being patient so that you're tolerant of somebody else. It's the same word. Hashem says, I will take you out from under sivlot. You hear the same, you hear that sound? Sivlot, savlanut. That's the act of being tolerant. Sivlot means the complacency, the tolerance. The great Hasidic master told us that perhaps the meaning here is that the Jews became tolerant of their situation in Egypt. They had forgotten, after being enslaved for so long, they had forgotten their nobility. They forgot that they used to have an aversion to foreign ideologies. They forgot that they used to have a feeling of spiritual discomfort around them, the Egyptians. They forgot all of that because they had adapted and they had become so a part of it that they didn't even realize there was something more. They didn't even realize they forgot, right? They became more of the mentality of, well, I guess we're just going to have to be slaves and our children, yeah, they're going to grow up to be good slaves too. And that's the new norm.
Kind of desensitized.
It's desensitized to a point of where you don't even realize you've adapted to the point of where that's just the way it is. The thought of changing, the thought of that there's another possibility had almost ceased across their minds. Part of the problem, and it makes so much sense, the very first stage of redemption of the Jewish people is to change the mentality. Hashem says, I will take you out, not just from the burdens, because that sounds very much like I'll rescue you from their service, right? Expression 1 and 2 seem very similar. I will take you out from under the burdens of Egypt and I'll rescue you from their service. Sure sounds to be the same. You're not going to do the harsh labor for them anymore. But what this master was telling us is that there's two stages here. If you want to be rescued from the physical labor to break free and be liberated, you have to do something first. The key to being physically liberated is to first have a mental change. Change your psychological perspective and realize this is not acceptable. Once you say it's not acceptable, all right, so now let's make a change. But until you make that switch in your head, you accept it. Even if the situation stinks, because that's human nature, because we hate being uncomfortable. So we become comfortable with whatever that situation is. The first step in any kind of growth in life, which is really what an exodus is where you break free from that which enslaves you. The first step is to say no more. I can't take this anymore. It's not acceptable. Now, I'm not suggesting that it's only to an extreme when things are so unbearable. No, what I'm sharing with you is how the human mind needs to work step by step. Even if it's a situation that's not life-threatening, even if it's not a situation that puts your entire relationship at, it's just not an acceptable situation. It's not for your benefit. Question it. Don't just become complacent and adapt to it. The first step of any redemption is this step. And if you want me to prove it, let's go back to the expressions. At the end of the fourth expression, I'll take you out. I'll rescue you. I'll redeem you and I'll take you for me as a people. The verse ends and comes full circle. And the verse says, I shall take you for me as a people and I shall be a God to you. And you shall know that I am Hashem, your God, who takes you out. And it repeats the same thing from under the burdens of Egypt. What do you mean? Weren't there four different expressions? Why are you repeating just the first one? Because that's the key to all the subsequent levels. If you can't get past level one, forget 2, 3, and 4. It'll never happen. The Jewish people needed to understand that they had to first come to a realization that they can no longer accept their situation. It's not acceptable. It's not to be tolerated. When you change the mentality, now you're ready for some kind of change. Doesn't have to be drastic, but that's the only way things are ever going to change. Perhaps this is the reason that Lecha Dodi tells us to shake off the dust and arise. You see, in the previous generations, the main objective was always to create a catalyst to be redeemed out of our exile. How? Torah, mitzvot, doing good deeds. That was always the catalyst. But nowadays, we have become so used to our situation. How many times have we stopped ourselves? Unfortunately, not enough. But how many times should we stop ourselves from talking about our kids and our grandkids and the plans of where they're going to settle here in Maryland or Virginia? What happened to getting out of this exile? Why do we just assume that the next five generations are going to follow and I want to keep my house here so that it becomes the family heirloom? It may be, but why is that an acceptable conversation? Shake off the dust. Get up. Wake up. This is not our permanent home. It never will be. Do I know whether it's happening now or 10 years or 50 years or 150? I have no idea. But I know this is not the long-term plan. That much I'll tell you. America, the United States, is the greatest blessing that we have. It really is. And I don't care what your political affiliation is. The fact that we can have this conversation without any fear of a Cossack or a Nazi or anybody coming into our homes because we're learning God's Torah, that's a blessing. And never, ever, ever take it for granted. However, that being said, this is not our permanent home. And the minute we realize that, we're not going to be complacent and just say, well, okay. Maybe we need to start asking the hard questions. Maybe there is the thought that maybe at some point I do need to consider making Aliyah. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm still here in Maryland too. Yeah. But at least have the conversation. Why do we have to become complacent to our situation? It's not. I hope and I pray that we don't get to the point of where it becomes so intolerable for us, we have to ask the question like it was in Egypt. But this is still human nature. The first step is to say, no, maybe this isn't the best for me. It explains something that bothered me for many years. I was told as a kid to try to appreciate what the Exodus was, that the quote was, no slave had ever been able to escape Egypt. That's what I was told, and I found the source for it. It's in the Midrash. Okay? I understood that Egypt was such a powerhouse of an empire, that it was the great security system, so to say, that no slave could have ever escaped. That's how, and yet, when the time came, God said for the Jews to leave, nothing stopped them. All the previous years, not one slave could get out. And look here, God says it's time to go. 2.5 million Jews pack out, no problem. See you, Pharaoh, we're out of here, right? And I understand, but it still bothered me. Really? Is this just a nice expression to try to impress upon us how tight, not one? There are jails that every, inmates seem to get out. They figure it out. You mean to tell me not one slave, not one Jew was smart enough to get out of Egypt? Couldn't figure out a way? I mean, come on. invent some kind of reed scuba gear and go swim under the Nile to get out. Who knows, you know? Maybe the Navy SEALs. I mean, it could have been not one.
They didn't try.
Yes. Number one, they didn't try. Not because no one could. No one wanted to. They became so complacent. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I'm sure that they had security systems. I'm sure they had guard dogs. I'm sure they had fences, right? But they had internalized the slave mentality to a point of where there was no point in leaving. It never even crossed anybody's mind to leave. When you have a slave mentality, you say, it's not so bad. Okay, I can deal with it. It's not what I would have chosen, but okay. No, no. They tell a sad but true story, I'm sure, of one of the great rabbis who had been gotten. You know, there's a custom in many circles that, as a tremendous sign of piety and greatness of a person, there's a certain section or certain selection of prayers that they would state, they would say at midnight, and it all talks about the wish of being redeemed and building the third Beit HaMikdash and all of that. I'm not familiar with it. You're stuck with me. Sorry. I'm not at that level. But they do. I know what at least they're talking about. It's called Tikkun Chatzot. It's the rectification at midnight. Whatever. Okay. The story goes that this particular rabbi was doing it and he was traveling and he stayed over at an inn. And the innkeeper sees him in the middle of the night and he says, what are you doing? And the rabbi said, I'm saying these collection of prayers over the bitter exile and can't wait to be redeemed and go back to Israel. It should be over. The innkeeper was very impressed. He goes upstairs to his room. He wakes his wife. Mistake number one. He wakes his wife and he says, wow, we have such a great person here. And he told her, he's praying about going back to Israel. And she looks, she's half asleep. And she says, go to Israel? What's going to be with our farm? What's going to be with our cows? What's going to be with our horses? I mean, come on, get real, dude. So he said, oh, it's a good question. He goes back down and he tells the rabbi the rabbi says, you're worried about the cows and the house and the farm and the barn. When the Cossacks come, when the Nazis come, you know, no more, you know, it's all going to be gone anyway. What are you, big deal? Okay. The innkeeper says, that's a fair argument. He goes back up and guess what? Yes. Mistake number two, wakes his wife again. And he says, he had a good argument. She says to him, no, he doesn't. If he's so concerned about that, then he should pray that God should take all the Cossacks and the Nazis and send them to Israel. Leave my house and cow alone. It's a sad but true commentary. That's what we would prefer. You know what? Let Mashiach come and let all the other nations, let them go somewhere else. I like my comfort here in America. I know we say it jokingly, but there is some truth to it. Sadly, we've become somewhat complacent with our situation.
Yeah. We haven't.
Sometimes we need a little bit of a wake up, get out of our regular routines, get out of our habits and question, is this the right thing for me? It's important to ask those questions. In fact, the most important night of the year when we want to convey the principles of our faith to the next generation at the Passover Seder, the entire theme of the night is structured as questions and answers. Mm-hmm. Not a dissertation about the 13 principles of our faith. It's not a discourse on the greatest, deepest. No, ask a question, give an answer. Because you know what? I never thought about that. That's a good question, Rabbi. I love when you raise a question and say, you know what? I never thought about that. That's great. I have to rethink this a little bit. Sometimes I have the privilege of sharing what I want to talk at one of my classes to one of my family members, and they'll ask me a question. And I'm like, how'd I miss that one? That's a good question. It's good I did this first with you and not with my text messages class. This you have to do that sometimes. There is such an importance. Let me finish with this last piece to it, and then we'll wrap it up. We're all familiar with the manna that fell from heaven that sustained the Jewish people for their 40 years in the desert. Miraculous bread, unbelievable. What happens? The people complain, they have nothing to eat. Typical Jews, right? Everything's such a gastronomical affair. Like, okay, Rabbi, it's a great sermon, but when's the Kiddush? I get it. We're always centered around food. Fine. So God says to Moses, tell the Jewish people that there's going to be manna falling from heaven every day. Okay? I'm going to let you in on a little secret. You didn't read this section in the Torah necessarily. It's there. But I'm going to let you in on an end of the story before it actually happens. The actual command that God gave Moses was that every single morning there will be enough man for a certain amount per person, and that's to be sufficient. And that's going to continue Sunday through Friday. But there will be no manna on Saturday, on Shabbos. No manna will fall. And in case you're wondering, Moses, how they're going to eat, don't worry. Give you a double portion on Friday. We're all familiar with this. I didn't tell you anything new yet, right? But what I am going to tell you that's novel is that if you take the time to read the text of the Torah, when Moshe actually tells over the story of what will happen, he, quote unquote, conveniently leaves out that last piece. All he tells them is that the manna will fall. As God said to me, don't worry. He will provide for you manna from heaven every single day, one portion per person. Don't leave it over. Don't take more. All the rules regarding that, but it's going to happen every day. And that's what happened Sunday. And it happened again Monday. And everybody's cool. This is, wow, this is awesome. Right? We got our own little personalized vending machine. And then Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday. And lo and behold, they get up Friday morning and there's two portions per person. And they go running to Moses, what's going on here? I thought you said it's going to be one a day. He says, thank you for reminding me. God told me to tell you that actually you're not going to get tomorrow. You're going to get a double portion. Really? Moshe has been so faithful. We read the story over and over and over again. He does almost every single thing to the letter of the law, exactly as God told him. And this time he left it out. I don't know what happened. I was thinking, I don't know. What do you mean? Why did Moshe leave out that piece? Rashi, I think, quotes this, if I remember correctly, or maybe it's in the Talmud. It says very specifically, Moshe made a judgment call. He was going to share that information. But if you want to make it real, you got to do something that's going to jolt the people. It's going to say, ho, what's going on here? That's not what I expected. He wanted to impress upon them the fact that Shabbos is so holy, there's not even going to be months. If he told them that on Sunday, he's going to be like, okay, everybody mark your calendar. Make sure, hey, write it in. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you're going to get this. But Friday, you're going to get this. Everybody be like, okay, whatever. You know, on Tuesday, Moses, what did you say about the end of the week again? Can you remind me? I didn't get that all down. Teacher, can you repeat that again? In one ear, out the other. That's the way we are, folks. I make light of it, but I'm not lying. That is who we are. Moshe purposely left it out. Why? Because we needed that jolt. He didn't tell the Jewish people from the outset how it was going to play out so that it became real. This is not what I expected. Oh, that's the reason. Now I get it. It impressed upon them what Shabbos means. He would have just said, oh, guys, look how special this is on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and on Shabbat. You've already lost me. You've lost me. This is more than a 4-second, 5-second commercial. Psh, I'm out. I'm tuned out. But when you see it firsthand, it's a jolt. Don't become complacent to a point of where you stop asking about your situation. Look at, internalize and say, am I enslaved by my situation? And I don't mean it in a harsh term, but have I just become on cruise control? I've become complacent and I just accept it for what it is? Or is there something I can do? Sometimes the answer is no. Sometimes you can't. And you do have to deal with that situation. But ask the question. Don't just accept it and say, okay, that's just the way it is. I'll end with this. I think I shared this story with you. I was in high school. And our teacher, great teacher, was talking to us about behaviors and someone said, yeah, but that's just the way I am, Rabbi. I'll give you more specifics. He was talking about making sure that you stick to the schedule. you get up at a certain time, and nah, nah, nah. And he and this kid raised his hand and said, I get it, Rabbi, but that's just the way I am. I can't get up, at, you know, when you're asking me to get up and do that. That's just the way I am. And the teacher very calmly looked at him and said, I hear you. I understand. But you're telling me the crime, not the excuse. You can't just accept that that's the way you... So change it! Are you an animal or are you a human being? If you're an animal, okay, so then that's your instinct. That's what you're stuck with. But you're not. You're a human being. And a human being has choices. Are some more difficult? Yes. Are some more challenging? Yes. But don't just accept it because that's the way it is. Well, that's what everybody does. That's ridiculous. You're not everybody. Ask your own questions, get your own answers, and do what you got to do. The first step, and this is what I want you to walk away with from our parsha, the first key, the first expression of redemption has to start with recognizing that you cannot just accept Sivlot Mitzrayim, the tolerance of being in Egypt. It's no longer acceptable. It's intolerable. I need to make a change. And then you learn how to change. Slow steps, one step. And you do it slowly. Doesn't have to be monumental overnight. But if you never ask the question and you just adapt and become complacent and tolerant, you'll never grow one bit. Ever. This is a key to all kinds of quote redemption in our life, of growing as a person. Don't just accept it. Question, learn, grow, shake off the dust, and arise. Questions? Haha, funny. Any questions? Appreciate it.
Tell Naftali, like, never mind.
I think they WhatsApped him and said, come on home.
We figured it out.
Yeah. Heads rolled on that one.
Just a quick comment as far as this dust thing. I mean, in a desert culture like that, I mean, you would, if you didn't do it, I mean, in a month's time, you'd have an inch dust on, you know, you'd soon be buried by the dust. And that's what happened in those cultures there.
That's true. But the Lachadodi wasn't written in that culture. Lachadodi was written by a man, Rabbi Shlomo Alkabetz, who's actually buried in Tzvat in Israel.
In Tzvat,
yeah. He was long after the desert times. But he's referring to this concept. I like Arlene's idea of that we have to shake off the schmutz from the week. Right? I get that totally. I love it. But I'm showing you that it goes even deeper. That this is a human condition that if we want to get to the end of that stanza that talks about redeeming us, getting out of this, there's only one way. Get up, shake off the dust, and stop being so darn complacent. It's the only way we're going to get out of this. Yes, Robin.
Yeah. So when we were talking about being exiled and this not being our, you know, permanent home and Jewish people going back to Israel, you were talking about in Egypt that they didn't question anything until it was intolerable. So do you think it's going to take for it to be intolerable for us Jewish people before it'll be questioned and go back?
Again, I'm not a prophet. All I can do is look at our history. Unfortunately, more often than not, we're not proactive. And we stay in a place where we become extremely comfortable to a point of where the country no longer tolerates us. And then the screws are tightened to a point of where we don't have a choice. That, unfortunately, is more of our history than the other way around. Right. I am not a prophet. I have no idea how this is last piece of the exile is going to play out. If I did, I probably wouldn't be doing the Zoom call. I'd be making some serious money.
Right. But I guess
I don't know.
Yeah. Making the point.
I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that enough of us will think proactively and say, I love it. It's wonderful. And if my situation allows, and I'm not saying it's for everybody. You know, I truly believe that to make any kind of life decision, you have to take all the factors into play, all of them, financial, emotion, family, literally there's 10 primary categories that one needs to consider. if you go through that checklist and it leans a certain way, so then you pursue it and you say, can it work? But it doesn't necessarily work for everybody. Like for me, I don't know what this future holds. I have no idea. Nobody does. But if you ask me, if you would have asked me 5 years ago, what's the likelihood that I would consider making Aliyah and moving to Israel 5 or 10 years ago, it is less likely than it is right now. Why? Not because necessarily of the situation, although that is a factor, is because my youngest child is already in high school. Once that child goes to college, I hate to say it, right? But theoretically, I don't have someone at home. That's a different situation than when I'm raising babies. To go ahead and to take children, it's very difficult. And I know plenty of people that have done it and have done it successfully. I just don't think for Tzmini Ilana Tachman that would work. But if you're asking me, are we having these conversations periodically? The answer is yes. The answer is yes. And especially if we're Zooming, all I got to do is stay up in the middle of the night and I can do this. You have no idea. You have no idea where I am. Where in the world is Rabbi T? A new game. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question, Robin?
Yeah, I was just saying it seemed to be that you were pointing that it might have to be intolerable before people
go forward based on history,
but we're hoping not. Right?
I sure hope not, but I'm not a fool to ignore history.
Right.
It would be hard for me to believe that our situation is so drastically different than so many others in our history. The golden years of Spain, I mean, they talk about those 500 years of such wonderful bliss that the Jews incorporate. And in Europe, prior to the winds of, we had a wonderful, wonderful host countries. But things do change. Unfortunately, that is the reality. I don't want to be the Debbie Downer. I'm trying to take the other side. I'm trying to say, be proactive and think about the questions. Don't just accept it. Think about it. Everything in life, if you want to grow, if you want to be better, which all of us do, then you have to ask questions, hard questions, because otherwise you're just going to accept this situation, status quo. That's not the Jewish way. We don't just accept status quo. Question it, learn from it, and or make a change. That's who we are. All right. Have a great Shabbos, everybody. Enjoy, stay safe, and we'll see you back here next week.
Good night, Rabbi T. Thank you.
Pleasure.